Hello, everyone. Hello and welcome to King's Place and welcome to this live recording of The Breakup Monologues, a podcast navigating the emotionally perilous terrain of relationship endings. Woohoo! Yes, there they are, the heartbroken people. Well, we're all hopefully going to bond and laugh about our heartaches and heartbreaks and loves and romances. But please welcome to the stage your host for The Breakup Monologues. It is Rosie Wilby. Aha! It's me. Hello. It was me doing the announcement back there. Yes, I'm multitasking. Oh, brilliant. I mean, honestly, Edinburgh Fringe, I had to turn lights on and off as well. So this is actually an improvement. Hello and welcome and thank you for coming along to the Breakup Monologues. Give me a cheer if you've ever actually listened to the podcast. A few people. Welcome, but the rest of you, you must go away and listen to all our previous episodes. We've had some fantastic people on. And the reason this all came about is because I've been studying love and sex and relationships and some of the weird, crazy psychology behind all that stuff for my comedy shows for a number of years now. Because it really is crazy stuff, love, isn't it? I mean, Freud described romantic love as a temporary psychosis. You're even taking notes already on little post-its. I don't know what that's all about. Say this on my next date. And don't leave it attached to your knee at the time. It's probably a good ploy. But yes, I've been reading some of those books about love and relationships. My favourite line in the book, The Joy of Sex, is actually in the chapter about kissing. Because kissing's my favourite part, because at that stage there's still hope. And in The Joy of Sex, in the chapter about kissing, it says, a good mouth-to-mouth kiss should leave its recipient breathless but not asphyxiated. So that is worth bearing in mind, isn't it? Now, cheer those of you who's ever had a relationship. So we're all experts, aren't we? We're all experts on all this love stuff. I've been fascinated for many years by the sort of body language between people who are together. You know, especially if you see a couple and one of them is shorter than the other, I always find myself fascinated and thinking, how did they get together? Did their eyes meet across a seesaw? And height difference is quite scientifically interesting. I don't know if you know this, because men often go for a woman who's shorter, women go for a man who's taller, even in heterosexual relationships. But did you know in the gay world, these desires that men and women have for a taller, shorter partner actually carry over? So it's quite hard for a short lesbian like me to catch you. I have a slightly taller lesbian because she's looking for a taller lesbian than that, and it carries on and on. An endless spiral. And in some ways, it's quite good too. Gay people can't actually create a baby together because, think about it, runaway evolutionary theory would mean that lesbians would evolve and get taller and taller and taller and taller and taller. Gay men would get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until we couldn't possibly all coexist in the same society, could we? It would be ridiculous. People would be like, oh, the lesbians are coming, run away. They're going to crush us with their giant Dr. Martin boots. Pick up that little teeny tiny gay man. He can't run very fast with those tiny legs. Yeah, here's some Darwinian theory for you there. Now, I have been a little bit luckier in love just recently, but I've had tons and tons of breakups, which is why I was really fascinated by them and kind of investigating how we could maybe do them better, communicate about them better. Because what happened to me a few years ago now, in 2011, right at the beginning of January, yes, classic New Year's breakup. it was really annoying because I'd given her quite a nice Christmas present. I got dumped by email, everybody. Yeah, I did feel much better about it, though, once I'd corrected her spelling and punctuation. And changed the font, actually, yeah. Yeah, peculiarly. Yeah, it turns out if you type breakup into Wingdings, a little police car comes up. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to get my two guests up for this episode this evening, and they are both, I think, eminently qualified to be here. So first of all, we have Brett Goldstein, whose Edinburgh show this year, What is Love? Baby Don't Hurt Me. So That kind of sounds like he's on the right tack, doesn't it, everyone? And he's amazing. He's been on lots of kind of telly stuff. You'll probably recognise him. He's really brilliant. But I haven't seen him for quite a few years, but it's fabulous to see him again. So please give him a wonderful warm welcome up to the stage, Brett Goldstein. Now onto my sofa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you. Hello. Is that on?
Is that on?
Yes, I think it's on. And now we were going to have Jen Brister, who's a very good friend of mine on the comedy circuit. Are there any Jen Brister fans in? Yeah. Oh. Well. Oh, this is awkward now. No, Jen is a very good friend of mine, and she had a bit of an emergency come up this morning, but because she is a wonderful human being, she had already lined up an absolutely amazing replacement. So I hope you're not too disappointed, because in her place we have the award-winning and wonderful podcaster, as well as being a comedian in her own right, the amazing Sophie Hagen!
A lot of Jen fans, weren't there?
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Jen Brister fans.
I feel kind of bad about killing her now.
Whoops! Oh no! Actually, Jen did a really sweet thing there, because there is a bit of a comedy industry ethos, isn't there? That if you can't make it to a gig, that you do offer up a suitable replacement. And I wondered. It got me thinking, because I thought that's a really nice thing to do, because it saved me a lot of hassle, kind of, you know, phoning people today at the last minute. I thought, could we have a similar kind of philosophy in the dating world? Where if you,
that is such a good idea.
Rather than like swiping right and thinking, no, I don't, you can't actually swipe right on that person and get rid of them off your dating app, off your Tinder, until you think, well, I'm going to find them some other matches who will like them. Do you think? Like a date substitute kind
of thing. I think that's a wonderful idea. It also would be great when you're breaking up with someone, if you provide a replacement.
Well, I mean, I was thinking...
On the day.
Here he is, or she is, or they are. That I was thinking it could be more tricky as you get longer term into a relationship. I mean, I suppose, you know, your partner might be a bit annoyed if, like, 10 years into your marriage, you've just rung up a mate and said, oh, I'm a bit bored, will you just step in? But, Sophie, did you think there's something in that? Could it work?
I quite like that, because when you do break up with someone, you know, it's bad news, isn't it? But then you could be like, I got good news and bad news. Bad news, we're over. Good news, remember my friend Dave? Oh, you said you liked him once. Well,
yeah.
He's moving in. Hope you like his kids.
All 10 of them. Yeah, so I think it could work. I think we're onto something there. Let's no one go and invent that app until you've paid us a lot. Some royalties for that. We've invented that. So what should we talk about? Well, Brett, you are talking about love in your comedy show.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've found it similar to me. Like, in some ways it seems like, oh, it's such a universal topic and we've all got stories about horror story dates and all of this kind of thing. But actually, when you start to unpack it and try to, as I think you do in your shows, really understand what's really going on in the sort of the real heart of it, it's such a difficult topic. Love is so fleeting and ephemeral, and it's hard to kind of grasp what's actually happening in the brain and in our hearts. And how have you found it trying to get to the bottom of it?
Well, what is interesting, you say it's universal, and I guess the more specific you are, I always think when I'm doing new material, when I'm doing new comedy bits, what I am really asking the audience is, am I all right? Is this normal? And if they laugh, you go, oh, okay. And if they don't, you go, oh, shit. And I think when you're talking about love and you're talking about, like, I think that addiction and love are the same thing, arguably,
yes,
in some respects. And so the danger is... which is which?
Well, they are closely linked, aren't they? There have been studies where they've looked at, where scientists have looked at the brain in love. People have been whizzed into a tube, willingly, I think, and shown pictures of their loved ones, and the areas that light up are exactly the same as the areas of the brain that are triggered when we're addicted to a substance, to a drug. So it really is a drug, isn't it?
But when you fall in love, properly fall in love, and you're like madly in love, it is like heroin.
I don't know. I haven't.
I've accidentally done heroin.
Accidentally? And, you just slipped onto
similar.
That.
It's a similar vibe. Yeah. Not to encourage. I mean, it's better to meet someone than do heroin. I'd like to make that clear.
Do
on
both.
It. Yeah. No. But yeah, it's when you must have had that. You've had it when you're madly in love and you can't see straight and
can't stop thinking about that person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I think there's a danger in the sort of modern media seems to present that very all-consuming early stage of love, that very passionate, very heady kind of, woo, there's all these amazing chemicals whizzing around. And we do kind of acclimatise to that. And in a longer-term relationship, a different type of love kind of comes in where the brain is doing something quite different. But I think we tend to think when we've got to that stage, we've actually fallen out of love. And I think that's perhaps where we're at the moment. And it's actually quite a dangerous place to be. I'm sure my parents kind of were not in that exciting, crazy stage a lot of their lives together, but they stayed together. But are we getting more impatient now, Sophie?
I mean, I think it's funny when you say addicted because that rings, I mean, that does ring true. I think I sometimes, I don't think I do it anymore, but I used to be more dependent. It just feels like addicted sounds a bit nicer, doesn't it? It sounds a bit more like, oh, I'm addicted to you.
I've sexed it up a bit. It means codependent, yeah.
But if you say, oh, no, I'm completely codependent now, and you're not allowed to go anywhere.
If you go, no, it's like heroin. People go, oh, cool.
No, I just think, I don't know if it's a, is it a generation thing, you think? I mean, I kind of long for that, the stories you hear from like my grandparents, you know, who met in a village where there were like five people. So it's more like an eeny, meeny, oh, you. kind of situation. It's just, I think, then you just choose one, don't you?
I guess you would do. Did they ever have a party in the village where all five kind of, you know?
They actually, my grandmother told me how she met my grandfather, and she told it in such a romantic way. I just loved the story for so many years, because she would go all like giggly. She'd be like 80, and she'd go, oh, well, I was 20 years old. And I was at this party in the village, and I saw your grandfather. And he was asking girls to dance, but they all said no. But then he asked me, and I said yes. And he married me. Because I was the only girl in the village who wanted to dance. And I was like, oh, my God, that is so romantic. I love that. And it wasn't until I was, like, 25 I spoke to her, and she told it in a different way. She went, I was the only girl in the village who wanted to, you know.
Oh, dance.
Granny yeah, that's was the a word bit of it. A slut. She was very like, oh, my parents used to think that I was going to be the last one married, but they didn't know that I was sleeping with the entire town.
Yeah. All four of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. It's actually not all that slutty. Where
as slutty as she could have been. For that, I'm proud.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in quite a small place. I always tell people Ormskirk, it's called where I grew up, and I don't know if anyone heard of it. And some people have heard of it. Hello. And I always tell people it's a bit near Liverpool. It's a bit like Liverpool if you take away everything. and it was kind of like the worst place to kind of... Because I think when you're young and you're starting to have a sexuality, you want to be the same as everyone else and just blend in and not stick out. And, of course, I started to realise that I was gay, which, like, the 1980s was totally the worst decade for being different in that way. And I think it's so difficult, isn't it, when you start to kind of realise anything about your sexuality that, I mean, we're all different and we're all unique and individual, but that sets you apart, I think, from other people. Do you sort of have any memories of your kind of burgeoning sexuality as a teenager?
I remember, this is going to put me in a really bad light.
Okay. You said that with a real glint in your eye.
Yeah, because I didn't have any bad intentions, but when I was 15, my very good friend, she sat me down and she was really, like, it was really emotional for her. And she said, I'm bisexual. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And she said, well, it means that I'm attracted to, you know, both men and women. And I went, everyone feels like that, you idiot. because I thought they did. I was like, well, me too. That's not a thing. No one cares. Goodbye. And it took me a while to realize that, wait, not everyone? It's just attracted to everyone. It took me a long time.
It's only the people from that village. Like, well, I may as well. I suppose you'd have to be bisexual. It just really limits your options, doesn't it, really? It's kind of really statistically a better bet. So, Brett, you have talked about porn addiction as well in your shows. I mean, we're talking about addiction.
Hello.
Oh, hello. But I was just wondering about the kind of our expectations of sex, because now, you know, younger and younger porn. Kids are exposed to porn. What does that kind of tell us about
I think I wrote a show about porn, and I did lots and lots of research, and I read I read arguments for and against and all this, and I just kept reading them thinking, yeah, but it is bad. I couldn't really come round to the, because I know, and it's mostly because of the speed and volume of the internet. It isn't necessarily that porn itself is evil or anything like that. It's the fact that it's instant, and it sets off things in your brain that need more and more and more and get darker and darker and darker. And children look at it.
Yeah.
And I do think it's all well and good sort of saying, to try to explain to a child, this is like fantasy. This isn't how real sex is. This is fantasy. But a child barely knows what real sex is, let alone, you know, it's confusing enough. Like, I remember, I always think back, I'm about to say The Cosby Show, I'm sorry. I apologise, but I did watch it a lot when I was young. And there was an episode of The Cosby Show, which was about drugs, where a girlfriend of Dr. Huxtable had been in a coma because she'd been on drugs. And I remember my mum and dad sitting me down after we'd all watched this episode and, like, talking me through, you know, you mustn't do drugs and stuff. But I think I was, like, 4, and I didn't understand what they were talking about. And I remember I said to them, what if they throw them at me? And I just, so it's like, so sometimes when I think, oh, you have to explain stuff to kids, you go, they've got little brains. They don't know what the fuck it is to start with, let alone going, here's images of, you know.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I watched porn. Well, it wasn't porn. It was like, I stayed up a bit too late. And then it was this really soft core. It was basically just like a man and a woman kissing, and then like a curtain flew in front of them. And but I was like 10, and I was like, holy shit. And I was just like, I've watched porn.
And you've had a curtain fetish ever since.
I was really like, oh my, and I was like, I'm sick. Like, this isn't okay. So I called. We have like I don't know if that's a normal thing in this country. I'm from Denmark, by the way. That's the accent. Yeah, some of you were like, there we go. And then we have a children's phone. Like, you can call a number if you have like worries as a child. And I called, and I was like, I think I'm addicted to porn.
And
the guy, he asked no questions. He just went straight into, what you've seen is not real life. That is not how it happens. And I was like, then how does it happen? I'm pretty sure I just thought it was people kissing and then they had sex. And he, in his head, I just watched like the most intense, like,
hardcore
orgy, like animal
curtains
thing.
Don't move in real sex.
Yeah. No curtains.
And he really scared me. He was like, listen, whatever you've seen, that is not how it is in real life. And I was like, then I don't know anything anymore.
Mm. Oh, yeah. It reminds me of when I first rang Lesbian and Gay Switchboard, when my mum and dad had gone out one evening. And they sort of comforted me and tried to make me feel less alone about being gay by telling me that Pat on EastEnders was also a lesbian.
That's
which
great.
Was a great comfort. When I remember one time I took just about porn as well. I was doing a sort of child friendly ish talk about my book about monogamy at Sunday Assembly, which you probably both know is run by comedian friend Sanderson Jones, and he changed my slides because I had a sort of survey about what counts as cheating in a relationship. And he changed my slide about looking at porn to looking at naughty pictures, sometimes moving. But then someone thought that it was that meant like emotionally moving. Oh. But actually, the lesbian porn that I did watch once, it did have quite a moving story. lesbian pornos always do have to have a story.
Was it set in the old Vic?
No, it wasn't actually, but that would have been a good callback.
Callback, yeah.
Yes, excellent. So, Sophie, you do a podcast, Made of Human, which looks at some of the kind of more painful and, ouch, tricky, challenging aspects of life. Have you had anyone who's kind of talked particularly about relationships and love? Because it does seem that breakups in particular, they do seem a real trigger for actually kind of exploration. I mean, sometimes in very healthy ways and good ways, but it can plunge people into a real sense of feeling adrift. I've just started reading the book Lonely City, where it's actually a relationship ending that triggers the writer into feeling this sort of sense of being really sort of floating and nowhere solid in her life. Have you had people sort of talk about love and how that has impacted them?
I have. I have a very bad memory. I know that I've done over 100 episodes, so the will, like, love
wow.
is one of those main.
That's a lot.
Yeah, you'd think people had heard of it by now.
Oh, I'm sure everyone here has, right?
That's very
yes.
sweet. That's very sweet. no, I have, and it's a weird one because I thought when I started the podcast, I thought I did it also for other people. But it turned out it was just me trying to fix myself and trying to figure out where I was. So a lot of I think you can hear it on the questions I ask. It's way more about me than
trying to find
an interview. I'm just going, but how? How do you do that? Tell me more. It's weird, isn't it, when you hear someone else's. Like comedian Tanya Edwards?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so she, it must be 4 years ago now. We were having a drunken night. We went back to Roisin Carnaty's place and we were all drunk. And we had this drunk conversation, and she was talking about her boyfriend. And the way she talked about him changed my entire relationship with love. Because I'd never heard anyone phrase it like that. I think before I spoke to her, I had this idea that love has to hurt a bit. It has to be really exciting, and, you know, it has to be a bit dramatic. And she was talking about her boyfriend going like, oh, he just makes me happy, and he's just this, like, calm, safe man, and I can go home to him and I know he's there, and it's just this, you know, this, we don't argue, there's no, she was probably saying it in a more succinct way, or I was really drunk so it sounded really poetic. But it just opened up for this opportunity that, oh, maybe love is just meant to be nice.
Yeah.
Which I just, and I was also a bit young, like I was very early 20s when that happened, and now I think it would have occurred to me automatically at some point, but that really changed a lot. And I think that's one of the reasons I think that having a conversational podcast, or just having conversations with people, can really change something in the way you approach stuff like love.
Definitely. I mean, I think there's certainly a feeling when you're in challenging relationships. I've been in relationships that I haven't felt I could possibly leave, because if I've spent that much effort and energy trying to fix it, fix me, fix them, or whatever I'm trying to do, you can't possibly just waste all that time. So you kind of stay because you think somehow there's going to be some triumphant ending that you're going to be the hero.
It.
Yeah, you're going to win the relationship.
Yeah. He's just given so much and surely I should get something back.
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait.
I think the email.
It's taken me, but this is the thing where I worry about, it's not universal, because sometimes when I say this, I think, oh, it's so obvious, like everyone else must know this, but bless you. But is that thing about calm, is that I've been in, I was in a relationship that I would say was awful, and I'd say she was emotionally abusive, I mean, difficult, and I'm trying to be, nice with it, but it was so... if I described any part of it, it would all sound negative. But I'd be lying if I didn't say, I suppose it was exciting, because I was never safe. Yeah. It was always like something, it was like, so I guess, because someone said to me, well, you must have got something out of it. And I was thinking, what? But it was probably that. It was like, well, it's thrilling because I'm scared. So
like a roller coaster.
So stuff's going on. And that must be love because I'm terrified. And then when you're with someone who's calm and you realise, oh, fuck, I haven't been with someone who's calm, you go, oh, is this meant to be it? But then you question it because you go, well, nothing's happening. We're just having a nice time. So this must be wrong.
Yeah. No one's throwing things at me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting because the scientists have done an experiment where people are kind of shown pictures of strangers and asked to rate their attractiveness. And some of the control group have not done anything before, just been sitting around. And some of them have been on an exciting, scary roller coaster ride. And the people who've been on the roller coaster ride are much more kind of turned on and kind of rate the strangers as really hot and really sexy. And so there is this kind of phenomenon of love at first fright, because you kind of associate that those feelings of excitement. You think, well, I must be somehow turned on or excited, but it's actually fear.
Terror.
I remember meeting, I had a whole like 2-year relationship which was based on all the bad feelings, but also the exciting feelings of jealousy and, oh, fuck you, I love you, no, I love you, fuck you, go away. All of that, like, we had half our relationship was, like, on a bridge in the rain, screaming. I was so romantic. And I remember the guy I met after that, it was, like, one of our first times really hanging out, and I wanted to make him jealous because that would prove that he was into me. So my housemate, this also makes me look bad, my housemate was standing at the bar, so I said to this guy I was seeing, I was like, that's Jack, he's so great, oh, he's just hot and wonderful, and he's just really, I just really like him, he's so funny. And this guy that I was seeing just like stepped up to Jack, and I was like, yeah, he's going to punch my housemate, that means he loves me. And he went straight up to Jack, and he went, Jack? And Jack said, yes. And he went, I've heard great things about you. And he hugged him. And I was like, oh, I'm a dickhead. That's so much better. Such a better quality in a person.
Yeah. I mean, I remember how in my kind of the one really challenging and difficult relationship I had, the big challenge was that she was not out to her family. And I somehow felt that if she came out to her parents, that would somehow prove, you know, that she loved me and that I was worth actually introducing your family to. And so this kind of went on for years that I was thinking, when's she going to come out to her parents? And she kept trying, and bless her, one time she did tell me that her parents had enjoyed the film Brokeback Mountain. so she was trying to kind of gay them up a little bit over time, but it didn't really work out. I wonder if, because as comedians we often try and deconstruct and understand love. I mean, Sophie, you were saying about how talking about it with other comedians and in podcasts and so on is really to kind of help our own lives and sort our own struggles out. I wonder if, is there a point at which, I sometimes worry that you can kind of unpack the mystery of it too much. I mean, some of the great sex researchers, like Kinsey and Masters and Johnson, they actually kind of had quite difficult romantic lives themselves, perhaps because we kind of see through too much of the mystery. Like, should we leave some of it just mysterious?
Probably.
Yeah?
But I think it might be too late.
Is it too late? Too late for you?
But I do think, I don't know if that's... I find it very difficult. Isn't that Buddhism, if we're meant to do that, we're supposed to just be in the moment, right? But I think most comedians are always on the outside of the moment, looking in, going, that's weird, that moment. And I think it's quite hard not to, but we probably should aim for it.
Yeah.
I guess.
What do you think, Sophie?
My best friend of like 10 years now, she's in the happiest relationship I've ever witnessed. They've been together for 7, possibly 8 years now. And I think, so she's Danish and speaks very little English. Her husband is from Senegal and speaks very little English.
Wow.
So they don't, I've seen them communicate, and it's weird because they don't. They speak completely past each other.
Is it just charades?
It's but what's so interesting is they function so well. They're so in love. And every single day, they're still in love. They still have a sex life. I probably shouldn't tell you that, but they do. And they have a child. And, you know, we've heard stories about how difficult it is to keep, you know, to keep the spark or whatever when there's a two-year-old.
Yeah.
But even they're still just, and then maybe that's the secret. It's just don't talk.
Yeah.
Don't talk. That's kind of completely opposite of what I've been saying in all of my shows and in my book. I've like been going on about communication, communicate about your boundaries and desires and needs and consent and all of that kind of stuff. But, well, I don't know, maybe. But surely they communicate perhaps on a deeper level than language, right?
Nah. Yeah. No, but I remember she had this big secret. Well, it wasn't a secret, but she was... We went to Senegal to see him before he moved to Denmark. And she was like, this is going to sound... Anyways, I'm just going to say it. So she can sometimes see into the future. She says, and I've seen things where I think this might be right. I don't know. I'm trying not to think of it. But anyways, she was like, how do I tell him that I can see into the future? you know what it's like. It's like that episode of Sex and the City. So I was like, well, don't do it when I'm here because I don't want to. That's like a private conversation. I don't want to be part of it. It's going to be really weird. And she was like, no, I'll just tell him now. And we were sitting in this cafe and we just ordered food. And she went, I can see into the future. And he said, yeah, I know. I can see things in my dreams. And that was it. They just stopped talking. They were like, okay.
Wow.
Like, if that had been me, if someone had said that, I would be talking for 24 hours straight. I would have 11,000 questions. I would dissect that and analyze that forever. Yeah. They were like, oh, cool.
God, I would want to know what's going to happen, yeah. Right? I mean, wow, that's amazing. So obviously, we are talking about breakups primarily, and you were telling us a story just in the green room before we started about an event you were going to go to, and then you saw on Facebook that an ex of yours was going to be going as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah. It was about a year, maybe 2 years actually, after... It is the breakup, but I called it after he broke me, because that's pretty much how it felt. It was like I've not really been able to trust anyone since. And I think I'm in a point now where if I ran into him in the street now, I wouldn't lose my shit, where it used to be like, if I see him again, I'll just... be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And then I saw him, he was going to attend this mutual friend's birthday, and I thought, right, it's time to see him, and then maybe, who knows, it's still there. So I texted him, and I said, hey, so I'm going to be at this birthday party. I saw on Facebook you were as well, so maybe we could have a chat, or I just hope you're okay with me going. And he wrote back, yeah, it'll be good to see you, just so you know, I'm going to be there with my new girlfriend. And I wrote back immediately, and you should never write back immediately. I went, yeah, that's great. I'm bringing my new boyfriend who exists. And he does not. He does not exist. And then, aww, I couldn't go because you don't want to ask any of your male friends to pretend to be your boyfriend for the night.
I would totally have done that.
Yeah, yeah. Brett would have been
your
boyfriend.
Are you on my texting list the next time that happens?
Yeah. Yeah. Aw. And so, I think that's a shame that you didn't go, because we were chatting about different strategies before we started, and someone suggested that you could have just had a coat on a chair and said, oh, he's on call tonight, my very dashing doctor boyfriend. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, do you bump into exes and kind of hide behind a bin? Or
I have mostly good... I have... of all the... I'm friends with most of my exes, but there's... I had a genuine, like, oh, I bumped into her at an event years later, and it was I was really shocked to see her, and I didn't quite know how to behave because we hadn't spoken, and it was like, and we'd had a lovely time, I sort of went over and we like did banter for 10 minutes. It was quite fun, and it was quite funny. But we didn't ask any questions about anything. It was just sort of like we were at an event and we just sort of took the piss out of the event. Okay. And then I thought, well, this has gone well. I'm going to leave.
Leave it before...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds okay. I mean, it's kind of strange how there's this feeling that... you know, some of our exes, it kind of, that person becomes a stranger. There's a line in the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is, I just think, such a really fabulous film. It's one of my favourites. And this idea that the two people might actually want to erase the relationship to kind of get over that pain. But then, of course, in the end, well, spoiler alert, just decide not to. But there's a line in the film where Jim Carrey's character says, what a loss to spend that much time with someone only to find out that she's a stranger. Aww. And I don't know, like, have you ever, either of you ever done that thing where you kind of quite obsessively go back through letters and text messages and emails to kind of prove that actually the relationship was real? You didn't just somehow imagine it all in your head.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, quite a lot. I think it's weird because I dated, well, the guy, the Xiaoqi on a bridge in the rain guy, was a Danish comedian who is now really famous in Denmark. So when I go back, his face is on every single fucking bus and every single poster everywhere, and it's the worst. And he's on television all the time. And when I see it, because he's a bad person, that's not even a subjective opinion. I'm not biased. Horrible man. But then when I see him on television, he pretends to be so nice, and I'm screaming at the television. He's going, "That's not you. Tell them about the cheating." And it's, but it makes me. It's really weird because, like, no one really knows we had that weird affair thing happening, because, like, it was never became like a public or official thing, and you just see, like, people talk about this person and him having this stage persona, like television persona, and you start to go, was that, did he, was he, because, like, that's not him, but was he like that, and how much have I imagined? And I think if you're in a position where you've been, like, gaslit or, like, told that you were crazy throughout an entire relationship, you do start to think, well, was I just making it all up? But then and that's when you go through the text and you go, oh, no, that's not him. Yeah, he was horrible.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I mean, there's definitely that sense of, kind of sometimes feeling that you're totally crazy. And, I mean, I've been in relationships where I think that maybe the person is seeing somebody else and it turns out they are. But, of course, they're denying it and saying that you're the one that's crazy. Just talking about how we get dumped. Actually, let's do a quick poll. Cheer if you've ever been dumped. So quite a few people, less over here somehow. And cheer if you are the person who always does the dumping. Oh. Get out. No. Oh, that was weird, because it was sort of more over here, like the dumpers and the dumpies are all over here, like quite a solid body. Are you both more dumper or dumpy?
I think I am guilty of, certainly in the past, of not, of sort of forcing it so that they dump me when I want out, like sort of...
Oh, the passive-aggressive kind of...
Well, making it like... Or just sort of, not that, but as in if they... If we have a conversation and they'll go like, do you think we should have a break? I'll go like, yes, but they've said it.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
And
you've
advice.
Not done anything apart from like skywriting, break up.
Whispering like Darren Brown it.
Break up with me.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Sophie?
I think it's kind of 50-50. I mean, not there's that many that I can make a whole statistic.
Yeah. But there weren't that many in the village.
I think I've
you been must have been to 20 villages.
I've had a few, actually quite a few breakups where I've said, like, it's not working out, I can't be with you, I'm sorry, I need to break up. And they've gone, no. And I've been like, oh. And then we've been together for like another year. Because I was like, oh, okay. I guess that's not a thing then. But then when I was young, when I was like 16 or thereabouts, I just kind of allowed myself to get into these relationships that I didn't really want to be in because I didn't like saying no. So, you know, I'd be 16 and with this guy for a month, and at the end I was just so, like, I never wanted to be with this guy. And he's like, I'm going to get in touch with my dad I've never seen before to tell him about you. And I was like, oh, we need to stop now. Like, this can't be. And you don't know how to break up with anyone at the age of 16.
I don't know if I do really in my 40s. I mean, you know.
But did you send them a Meatloaf song?
No.
he sent me like a Britney Spears song. Like, I love you, I love you, something. And then I was like, oh, because I didn't know how to break up with him. And then he sent me that song. He was like, that's how I feel about you. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So I sent him 2 out of 3 Ain't Bad, which is, the chorus is, I want you, I need you, but there ain't no way I'm ever going to love you. But don't be sad, because 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Okay, that's, yeah. Subtle is that, messaging
is that,
there.
Is that better than the email? Or?
I'm not sure.
Is MSN Messenger?
it's creative. Well, for any of you who don't like breaking up with someone, I don't know what you think of this, but I found out today, I read about a company in Toronto, the Breakup Shop, where you can actually pay a fee and they will send a text message or a letter or they would even do a phone call. I don't know how that would work, to say, oh, you know, I'm sorry, but X, insert name, has decided to end their relationship with you. And so they'll send the message for you, which is ridiculous, right?
That's horrendous.
Yeah, that's worse than anything, apart from ghosting. Ghosting is the worst.
Yeah, we all know what ghosting is, right? Where you just kind of disappear.
You just stop. You just cheer if you, stop if, all contact. You just
cheer like, if you've ever been ghosted. It's all the same people. It's really pretty bad ghosting. Well, thank you so much. I think we'll wrap up there, but thank you so much to my guests, Brett Goldstein and Sophie Hagen.
Thanks for having me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
A Big Things Media production.